Thank you, David, for the introduction. I'm not sure I'm an expert on Aung So. I just happen to be the only one who has been working on him, that's all. So I look forward to hearing your feedback as well. Now, thank you for being here this evening for the second round of Escape Trajectories. I would like to thank everyone at the HKW for initiating and seeing through Kanonfragen to address the question of canons in modern art beyond Europe and North America, in East and Southeast Asia in particular. I'm certainly not the only person who is grateful to David Tay, the curator of Misfits, for bringing together Bajie Aung So, Tang Chang, and Roxley in this context. There are also the many friends and fans of the Burmese artists in and outside Myanmar, in and beyond this life, who have long lamented his lack of official recognition. This lecture titled Neither Nor, an interpretation of Bajie Aung So's art, practice, and location, looks at Myanmar's most acclaimed exponent of modern art from the second half of the 20th century. To respond to the themes of Kanonfragen, Misfits, and Escape Trajectories, my narrow imagination conditioned by a classical art historical training will do its best to address some of the ways in which Aung So's art, practice, and location elude or defy and call into question the presumably universal premises and frameworks of modern thought and art. Location here has a second meaning extending to where and how he might be situated with respect to the diversifying narratives and canons of art today. I will conclude with observations and interpretations which will hopefully stimulate fresh approaches to seeing, thinking about, and telling stories of art. In this lecture, the word story will often be used instead of history, given that the histories we inherit are essentially made up of stories shaped by each epoch's societies and individuals' aspirations and fears. The storyteller of art that I am finds the word story to be a more accurate description of my output. It is through the new stories written by each generation that the memory of an artist lives on, and what I share this evening is hopefully merely one of the many stories to come. The trope of neither nor is taken from Buddhist thought, which permeates Aung So's art, as we shall see. It partakes of the principle of not to, which goes back to the Vedas and is here applied to make sense of the seemingly paradoxical and incongruous aspects of Aung So's art, practice, and even legacy. Not to transcends modern dualistic thinking, dispenses with dichotomic oppositions, and conceives all phenomena as components of a network of interconnected nodes, containing and reflecting each other like a net of polished jewels, as per the metaphor of Indra's net standing for the concepts of void or shunyata and dependent origination or paticca samyupada in the Buddhist Avatamsaka or Flower Adornment Sutra. Stripped of constructs, labels, and conventions, this multifaceted and dynamic state of not to or neither nor is, in my opinion, the ground zero at which a more even-handed narrative of a sui generis artist like Aung So is likely to emerge based on an adapted set of conditions and criteria. Now, let me highlight that the many images that you are going to see on the slides, they are not shown to scale. These are examples of Aung So's signature works from the last decade of his life in the 1980s. Most of them are felt-tip pen on paper no larger than A4 size, and their pictorial idiom ensues almost three decades of experimentation on a broad spectrum of pictorial strategies from different parts of the world and historical periods, as per the instructions received in 1951-52 at the art school founded by Nobel laureate Rabindranath Tagore in Shantiniketan in India. Arguably cubist traits, curvy linear line work said to be of Oriental inspiration, and principles of Burmese painting, for example, coalesce to form a seemingly eclectic but ultimately coherent unit. There is no single dominant source of stylistic inspiration. These works correspond to a period of intensified meditation practice and were designated by the artist as Mano Mahait Di Dat Baji, meaning in Burmanized Pali, the painting or art of immense mental power cultivated through meditation. It is this category of works that forms the basis of our study. One of the biggest challenges to interpreting Mano Mahait Di Dat Baji is its unwanted conjugation of elements that are commonly perceived as contradictory. Text and image, the abstract and the figurative, the traditional and the modern, the local and the international, the oriental and the western, the scientific and the poetic, the sacred and the profane, the erotic and the spiritual. It does not even correspond to expectations of conventional knowledge, let alone ready-made art historical frameworks. Hence, the prioritization of these problematics at the heart of Aung San's art. Here, a slapdash representation of a common scarecrow is juxtaposed with the highly revered mantra of the Heart Sutra. More sacred Buddhist mantras and yantras are scattered around a voluptuous female figure in another work. In another two examples, we discern an integration of motifs derived from traditional Burmese art and contemporary popular culture. The former's unit of design in the form of a stylized vegetal motif is here adapted to serve a new iconography of a sensuous female figure and an airplane. While it is arguable that they are characteristically Burmese, they do not fit in with the model of Burmese art relayed in art historical publications and the mass media, whether in Myanmar or abroad. Our only certitude about the subject matter is that it is not simplistically one or the other. What might be the reasoning behind this melding of visual references resting on opposing ends of a linear continuum? Proposed are interpretations of two of the many binaries: one, the traditional versus the modern, and two, the sacred versus the profane. With respect to the traditional and the modern, also argued in favor of a synergy between the two, as you might have understood from his citation in the brochure for Misfits. He also taught modern art as a constantly evolving process. What is modern today will become tradition tomorrow. He went as far as to argue that ancient methods of mental cultivation were ahead of modern science, something which neuroscientists studying the effects of meditation have increasingly affirmed. This insistence on a complementary relationship between the old and the new is to be traced to Tagore's thesis of the past as a granary for the future, a refutation of colonial propaganda's antithetical framing of the two, whereby modernity and modernization are conflated with westernization, and all that is traditional and local are projected as backward and irrelevant. In other words, in parallel to Aung San's reconfiguration of the relationship between the modern and the traditional is the complication of that between the Burmese and the world beyond. The notes of inquiry in Mano Mahait Di Dat Baji crisscross and are interdependent. What about the seemingly irreverent infusion of sacred references? Buddhist traditions, usually practiced in isolation, are not only juxtaposed and associated with non-Buddhist spiritual methods and supports, such as the yoni from Hinduism and the tai chi tu from Taoism, but also elements of the sensuous world. Set in a grid of sacred numerals and letters of the Burmese alphabet, the silhouette of a corpulent middle-aged woman stands in for the Burmanized Hindu goddess of knowledge, Thuyatati, identifiable by her mount of the sacred swan, for example. Secular and modern methods of making sense of the world, such as geometry, poetry, biology, and physics, are also amalgamated in line with the principle of consilience based on the unity of knowledge. A mathematical graph illustrates the impermanence of conditioned phenomena, here specified as Sankara in Burmanized Pali, as the image in the middle. Einstein's formula on mass-energy equivalence is juxtaposed with signs and symbols from local spiritual practices and mathematics. As can be seen in his notes to his students, Aung San's idea of an education included the study of meditation, mathematics, psychology, the esoteric arts, and the natural sciences too. To my knowledge, no other artist from Myanmar is known to have advised likewise. It seems to be unprecedented in the history of modern art in Myanmar as well as Southeast Asia. It has been primarily the commentaries of Buddhist scholars and teachings of modern Buddhist tantric and Zen practitioners and masters, two Buddhist traditions repeatedly cited by Aung San, that shed light on the logic underlying the seemingly paradoxical elements of his art. By logic, we lean on Claude Lévi-Strauss's argument that even something as foreign to modern science as magical thought is not without its own logic. Quote, like a shadow moving ahead of its owner, it is in a sense complete in itself and as finished and coherent in its immateriality as the substantial being which precedes it. It forms a well-articulated system and is in this respect independent of the other system which constitutes science, except for the purely formal analogy which brings them together and makes the former a sort of metaphorical expression of the latter. End of quote. A succinct commentary that encapsulates the significance of Aung San's melding of entities which are conventionally interpreted as antipodal comes from Chogyam Trungpa, one of the first Tibetan tantric masters to teach in the West following the Tibetan uprising. He writes, quote, in the tantric tradition, the experience of life is regarded as an endless ocean, a limitless sky, or it is regarded as just one dot, one situation. Therefore, the idea of not two or the Advaita principle is an important principle in tantric Buddhism. It is not two, but not two does not only mean be one. If you do not have two, you also do not have one. It is just no rather than even not. It is one value, which means no value. End of quote. This tantric state of mind is comparable to that preceding the linearization of thought and the invention of the alphabet, whose manner of operation has been defined by André Leroy-Gourhong as radio thinking. It is said to be uninhibited by the intellectual process which letters have strung out in a needle-sharp but also needle-thin line, end of quote. Admittedly, if Manor Mahaidi Datbaji has been perceived as inscrutable both in and beyond Myanmar, it is perhaps also because its perception involves cognitive processes we no longer excel at. It, in addition, begs an adapted mode of expression capable of articulating its logic and genius. Given Aung San's interest in Tibetan Buddhism and Tantra, to the extent of adding mantras written in the Tibetan script to his works, he could not have been unaware of the notion of not two expounded by Trungpa, even if not in these exact words. It is no coincidence that he repeatedly inscribed the formula of 1 plus 2 equals 1 associated with esoteric arts in Manor Mahaidi Datbaji. Similarly, not three does not actually mean be one, but rather a one situation, an empty yet full space like Trungpa's endless ocean and limitless sky, in which advanced spiritual transformation may be accomplished following the silencing of the conceptual mind and conventional knowledge. In Aung San's words, it is the unity of, quote, one, form and two, mind, end quote, which has nothing to do with the ways of mathematics. In a nutshell, it is crazy wisdom, a term also coined by Trungpa to mean tantric intelligence. Considering Aung San's propensity for playing the madman, possibly to circumvent the pressures of a highly censorious and conservative society, crazy wisdom was arguably his mode of existence too. He behaved and dressed in unusual ways as if it were his duty to disrupt the climate of subservience. A belt is never worn over the traditional lower garment, for example. And he took delight in the company of patients interned at the mental hospital where he was similarly confined during fits of inebriety. He was neither the sage nor the lunatic. He embodied the entire spectrum of the two. The Zen Enso is probably the most well-known symbol for this one value, which means no value. Although almost unheard of in Myanmar, it appears in a significant number of Aung San's works and notes, and is likely to have been the inspiration for his zero theory. He wrote, quote, "Do not think that the small number zero is worthless, insignificant, and of no importance," end of quote. He further indicated that it signified a good number of things. It can be a graphic component, the letter of the Burmese alphabet Wa, the number zero, a ball, a face, the sun, the moon, the world, and even more when combined. Its polyvalent character is characteristic of Aung San's liberal manner of associating imageries and semantics with minimal preconceived notions of the right and the wrong. Forms, colors, and ideas take on multiple meanings and roles so freely that it can be short-sighted to prescribe rigid parameters for their interpretation. Alongside this, his animated words often replete with esoteric signs and symbols, are seemingly naive representations, as if Aung San subsequently came full circle from the depths of erudition to simplicity. Precisely because a single form can be so many things at one time, its intended meaning is ambiguous, and deliberately so. Aung San's signature, which at times doubled up as a pictorial motif, was variably explained on different occasions. He said it was the pattern painted on children's cheeks using ground tree bark functioning as sunscreen, but he also said that it was the design found on prehistoric ceramics and the planets of our solar system, all of which are probably valid. Underlying Manoh Mahaik Didatbaji's multi-layered significance is arguably the central theme of uncertainty, flux, and the dependence and interpenetration of phenomena. A practitioner of insight meditation or vipassana meditation also would have observed that no phenomena exists independently and immutably, not even the breath. Thoughts and recollections come and go like clouds in the sky. The breath rises and falls like the movements of his felt-tip pen across paper. Conceivably, the Buddhist tenet of impermanence and the law of dependent origination contained in the principle of not to are even etched in the very materiality of Manoh Mahaik Didatbaji. Also could not have been ignorant of the properties of felt-tip pen on paper, an unpopular medium that relegates his art to the hinterland of an art market and art historical narrative centered on oil and acrylic on canvas. He could not have been unaware of his compounded vulnerability in sunny and humid Yangon. His insistence on using it nonetheless constitutes participation in the accelerated disintegration of his own works. In so doing, for the same reason why monks of the Tibetan lineage make and destroy sand mandalas and butter tomas upon their completion, he sublimated attachment, subdued the ego, and transformed greed and anger into a state free from greed, anger, and ignorance through artistic practice, as he specified in a text at the back of a drawing shown in the exhibition Misfits. The spiritual transformation continues with the viewer or owner of the works, who experiences at first hand the veracity of the said principles through the fading colors and browning paper. In Myanmar, homage to Aung San has been paid in the form of exhibitions and anecdotal articles, both ante-mortem and posthumous, many of which have been uploaded to the open access database of Aung San's illustrations. In the eyes of fellow Burmese artists, he remains the most outstanding avant-garde artist of the modern period. Perceived as immensely talented, flamboyant, tormented, impoverished, drunk, and mad, he embodied his countrymen's and women's ideal of the self-sacrificing artist above material gain and fame, as well as the modern myth of the genius artist. For intellectual students and avid readers that most Burmese were, he was, in addition, Myanmar's most illustrious illustrator. Some might also recall his cartoons. In the literary and publishing world, being the poet's artist par excellence, he was given carte blanche for the most part of his career to illustrate as he wished. To the commoner uninitiated to modern art, he was a movie star in more than 20 films. Even when he caused traffic to come to a standstill in his drunken stupor, the initially furious driver was elated that the offender was none other than Aung So. Although the enfant terrible of the Yangonai art world is less remembered as a contributor of articles on art history and criticism, he was one of the few artists who wrote prolifically throughout his career. He was in addition a part-time lecturer for art history and graphic art at the then University of Rangoon and Rangoon Institute of Technology between 1962 and 1978. In other words, contrary to the definition of professional artistic practice, drawing and painting were not always Aung So's exclusive or even principal activity. Although his legacy as an artist is uncontested, at many points in time, he was more committed to other activities. In spite of his unparalleled fame as Myanmar's most avant-garde artist, he was tempted to commit himself wholly to cinema at one point. To begin with, he did not aspire to be an artist in his youth. His first ambition was to be a cartoonist to denounce social injustices and hypocrisies. Whether it is to address his practice as a painter, an illustrator, an art critic, or a film actor, his parallel activities need to be examined in conjunction. For example, if we are to disregard his illustrations and examine only the original works that have survived, we avail ourselves of less than 5% of his earth out of approximately 6,000 documented works so far. It would be impossible to trace his evolution on a month-by-month basis from 1948 to 1990. Besides, given that most Burmese artists illustrated, the study of modern Burmese art would be incomplete. To turn a blind eye to his proximity with the literary world will likewise downplay the pioneering role of writers in the genesis of modern art in Myanmar and the region. Unlike the painters whose assimilation of imported isms was quite systematic, leading literary figures called for reflection on an autonomous modern Burmese art. They were the ones that talent spotted Aung So, beginning with the Gong Taya, whose periodical Taya launched him as an illustrator and artist in 1948. 3 years later, in 1951, Min Tu Wen and Zhao Ji recommended him for the Indian government scholarship to study art at Tagore's University in India. These writers were and are revered as Myanmar's most gifted intellectuals, and their unanimous endorsement of the young artist anointed him. Indeed, if in spite of the pittance for each illustration, Aung So contributed works to illustrate poems, novels, and short stories without fail every month, it was partly out of gratitude, mutual love, and respect for Myanmar's writers. This milieu was his wellspring after all. It is otherwise uncertain how and where he might have conducted his extensive pictorial experimentations and made his art easily accessible to all strata of the Burmese society. The art market was barely existent during the socialist period between 1962 and 1988. And there were only a handful of galleries in which artists could exhibit. But most importantly, Aung So was against the commodification of art and believed in bringing art to the masses. The world of publication was hence the most obvious recourse. Now, what about Aung So's writings? If his claims in the anthology From Tradition to Modernity are to be believed, he saw it as his responsibility to give back to society, and this he did through illustration, as well as by writing on art from different parts of the world from the early to the modern period. Subsequently, with Manor Mahaidi Dat Baji, which baffled many, he also wrote to explain his practice, although he refrained from defining and the meaning of any work. In other words, Aung So's practice as an artist involved a social dimension as an educator, an aspiration that eludes modern art's paradigm for which responsibility towards society and future generations is not a prerequisite. Ong So's work on disseminating art historical knowledge through writing and teaching, however lacking in theoretical rigor, is all the more significant against the context of an intellectually suppressed Myanmar in the second half of the 20th century. Even though there is no evidence that he was successful, given the poverty of scholarship on art in Myanmar today, according to Burmese intelligentsia today, amidst the climate of apprehension in a repressed society under military rule, his articles were an inspiration giving rise to a novel artistic consciousness. While the pertinence of Ong So's activities in film is tenuous with respect to his artistic practice, an awareness of this parallel career contextualizes his aura as Myanmar's most enigmatic artist. His on-screen presence inevitably added to his larger-than-life persona, which so overwhelmed his fellow countrymen and women that they grew to perceive him as a genius artist surpassing mortal understanding. This has severe consequences for scholarship on his art. For even today in Myanmar, it is routine to conclude that Ong So was phenomenal without questioning why he behaved in a certain way, said or wrote certain things, or what his art might be about. As an art historian writing the story of an artist, the focus is clearly the art, not the artist's inclinations, relationships, or any other activity beyond art. An art historian is not a biographer. The rigor expected of the art historical discipline does not allow one to digress, and rightly so. However, in the case of an idiosyncratic and versatile artist like Ong So, who experienced every aspect of his life as art and did not lead a private life distinct from his public persona, it is the aggregate of his practices along with their matrix that yields a comprehensive understanding of each of them, individually and collectively. Ong So was not a painter-artist insulated from his country's ecosystem of intellectuals, writers, filmmakers, and painters. He slipped in and out of roles and fields, bearing insights to nourish his other activities. To begin with, he did not practice art as a specialization and economic activity, and does not fit into the mold of the professional artist inserted in the art market. Before moving on to the last part of this lecture on the location of Ong So's art and practice, we recall his 24/7 practice as a Buddhist, which amongst his many pursuits is the most crucial to making sense of his art in and on his own terms. But it is also the most awkward with respect to the positivist methods of art history, especially in modern art. It is not even a pursuit that partakes in the economy of modern secular society like cinema or illustration. The cultural fact and historical factors specific to Ong So's location in 20th century Yangon alone lay bare how there can be no facile story of his art aligned with art historical frameworks shaped by a Eurocentric historical experience. This contextual investigation merits an entire lecture on its own. I have alluded to some of these factors and now bring to your attention how polyvalent practice was lauded, not disparaged in Myanmar. Instances of crossovers between art, literature, and film in Myanmar were not rare. Banji Somo, who directed Ong So in a few films, for example, is also an excellent and successful painter. Acclaimed film director Wu Dumao wrote and painted too. The concept of the professional excelling in a single field had no currency in this culture, where painters, writers, and filmmakers worked in symbiosis. Other factors include the local perception of art and painting, Buddhist ethics, conditions for the inception of modern art, censorship, etc. But with respect to the theme of our gathering, of greater pertinence than Ong So's physical location is his place in the history of art. Although he is recognized as the leader of modern Burmese art, his works are not at all representative of his peers, whose media and pictorial idioms are relatively undifferentiated from Western modernist painting. To date, to be modern in Myanmar continues to be conflated with being westernized or being international. Ong So's exclusive initiation to Tagore's definition of true modernism as freedom of thought freedom of mind and independence of thought and action, made him an exceptional artist at the price of being an outsider of his own country weighed down by intellectual and cultural servitude. As argued in previous papers, if Aung San's art and practice must be attached to a nation, it is to that of Tagore's Shantiniketan, not Myanmar. The parallels between his philosophy and the ashram's teachings are remarkable and impossible to dismiss. Even though he was physically in Yangon after leaving his alma mater and did not ever return to India again, his conversations, writings, and works of art suggest that his thoughts never left Shantiniketan. It was from this ashram, aspiring to be where the world would roost in one nest, that he spread his wings to draw from the depths of ancient and esoteric knowledge, insights to nourish his own artistic practice. Between Southeast Asia, of which Myanmar is a part, and South Asia, it is the latter that offers greater potential for interpreting Aung San's art. Historically, it was also the subcontinent that the Burmese looked to, not the region called Southeast Asia today, a very recent construct whose invention during World War II paid no heed to the histories and realities of the peoples concerned. This said, Aung San has no place in the history of Indian or South Asian art either. His art can neither be straitjacketed into national and geographical identification, whether it is Myanmar or India, Southeast or South Asia, nor can it be understood as divorced from their histories. His art straddles not only histories, but also territories. And it was intended as such in every way, given his position against nationalist discourses and his nuanced identification of himself as both a Burmese and citizen of the world in the spirit of Tagore. Lastly, how about Manor Mahaidi Dat Baji's location in the master narrative for Buddhist art? As the first part of this lecture sought to demonstrate, by the time Aung San articulated his signature idiom, Buddhist thought and practice had become its path and goal. Artistic creation was the very means of spiritual growth for him. Manor Mahaidi Dat Baji is, however, not the didactic illustration of Buddhist tales as made clear on the back of a drawing shown in Misfits. It is the interiorization, performance, and transmission of Buddhist tenets through the creation and contemplation of art or painting. This makes him yet another outcast in the history of Buddhist art whose focus on stylistic analysis and iconographic identification is heedless of the raison d'etre of Buddhist images as tools and processes of merit-making, mental cultivation, and spiritual transformation. For Aung San, form was not an end in itself. The dominant nation-centric approach in Buddhist art history does not even accommodate the reality of interwoven and adapted Buddhist traditions. In fact, Manor Mahaidi Dat Baji cannot be understood by way of academic research alone. There are insights that must be distilled from actual practice. In the contemporary field, even though scholarship on contemporary Buddhist art still lags behind contemporary artists' engagement with Buddhist thought and practice, their works have been integrated with greater success into the international circuit and canon than Manor Mahaidi Dat Baji has been into the modern. I know no good reason that explains the difference and would be grateful if you have insights to share. What is clear is that the history of Buddhist art we have inherited is in urgent need of a fundamental reappraisal. Does it then mean that we have no option but to speak of Aung San as a misfit or a runaway? It is true that his art rests in no man's land. Both nouns identify the artist as the active agent of the deviant situation, but is his art historical exile, not at least in part due to our own blind spots, due to the tinted lenses we have inherited? Absence is also possibly due to the absentee eluding the system's radar or being deliberately written out of the master narrative. To begin with, there is a range of nuances to absence, for which there are multiple explanations. It could be escape out of fear, retreat due to the need for self-preservation, voluntary departure to seek more advantageous conditions elsewhere, resignation out of this illusion, exit because there is no good reason to stay on, withdrawal for reasons unknown, etc. In the case of Ong So, if we return to Buddhist thought and practice to explicate the situation using language known to him, the word refuge repeated in daily prayers in Myanmar, quote, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha, end of quote, suggests a different impetus. If Ong So worked in isolation away from the mainstream, it was not necessarily because he dreaded the younger night community of artists, or if he wanted to escape or saw his peers as below him, although he did despise those whom he considered to be painting for fame and gain. Probably it was because isolation was a prerequisite for serious study and spiritual betterment. Besides, the lessons he received from Tagore School, which became his roadmap, were so groundbreaking that he had none to dialogue with in Myanmar. We should also be reminded that Ong So never left Yangon, the financial, cultural, and artistic capital, for the countryside or the mountains in the north. For almost four decades, he was ever present through his illustrations, writings, lectures, and movies. His retreat was intellectual, artistic, and spiritual. It was purposeful and at times defiant, but it was not out of desperation or ineptitude. To be exceptional is to defy conventions, and by that, any outstanding artist ineluctably challenges prevailing frameworks and canons of artistic excellence. They also operated in a Kafkaesque society whose parameters, drawn up by a purportedly socialist government run by the military for professedly devout Buddhist people and snared in superstitions of all sorts, only amplifies his exceptionality. And by extension, the equivocality of his art and his place in the history of art. Ultimately, it is his rejection of the commodification of art and removal of himself from the art market that seals his legacy as an outsider of any canon, something which his fellow countrymen and women are hoping to change. Ong So's location in the history of art requires our attention before we attempt that of the canon. But which history of art? The question we need to first address is perhaps what might be the shape of the emerging and evolving histories and canons of art in which it might reside. In addition, what might be the nature of his relationship with them? The histories of art which Ong So enters and exits, Buddhist art, 20th century Burmese art, Southeast Asian art, South Asian art, Asian art, etc., which do not necessarily ensue identical constructs of art in the first place, are either being rewritten or written. Until each of these narratives are articulated with greater clarity, attempts to ascertain where and how they might overlap, intersect, repel, or complement each other, and where and how Ong So's art might be located in relation to them would be akin to building castles in the sand. There is, in addition, the question of who and what shape a history and a canon. If there must be a master narrative and canon, according to what criteria of artistic excellence and from whose point of view is it to be determined? Even if it is simply assumed to be Euro-American, the agents and context of this Euro-American hegemony need to be specified. It is not even a monolithic. Take the example of modern Burmese art. Should this story and canon be defined from the standpoint of Burmese artists, foreign academics like myself, since there is no homegrown scholars of art from Myanmar, curators of collecting institutions in North America and Europe, or local, regional, or international art dealers and collectors? The reason why I'm asking these questions is because I don't have an answer. With respect to the art market, whose role in the canonization of artists back conscientious studies, is there a sufficiently developed one for modern Burmese art in the first place? The local art market that was virtually inexistent before 1990 is still at a relatively nascent stage. There is no consensus on the price of Ong So's works, whose value in Myanmar is now virtually reduced to the number of zeros in US dollars, a perversion of all that he stood for. If we must speak of the canon, may I propose canons in the plural as a competing tool of thought? There is no one fixed center or canon and periphery. we are also outsiders of the regimes we are part of. The impossibility of a single constant point of reference is particularly true of communities whose past was as turbulent as it was multicultural as Yangon in the 20th century. Also, as do all self-aware artists, make informed choices to navigate between power structures, local, regional, and international, cultural as well as political. Even a Burmese painter that replicates the Cubist approach does so in response to multiple matrices beyond Euro-American canon, whose assumed universality persists. Histories and canons of art are interdependent constructs mutually containing one another as they evolve, expand, and contract, much like the aforementioned jewels in the metaphor of Indra's net from the Avatamsaka Sutra on the principle of non-duality and their interconnections back scrutiny. The inadequacy of national histories, the fallacy of a unilateral historicization, the constraints of the construct of the professional artist, the inadequacy of our tools of thought structured along binaries, and the need to rethink the premises of what we refer to as Buddhist art, modern art, and even art beyond imperialist agendas are some of the lessons we can take away from Aung San's current situation. There is no choice but to relinquish labels and ready-made theoretical frameworks to pay attention to what is at hand, to think and to find new vocabulary to articulate that which has yet to be named without suppressing, distorting, or diminishing the particularities of his art and practice. Thus far, it has been art historian Michael Baxendale's exhortation to relinquish the indiscriminate application of clerkly apparatus and theories and to pay close attention to the art at hand, not as static products, but in terms of complex evolving processes subjected to multiple factors that best complements the central principle of neither nor in Aung San's art and offers the greatest potential in resolving the methodological impasse. Instead of relying on familiar tools of analysis and technical vocabulary, we might do better by revising the language employed to translate indigenous thoughts too. The Burmese word baji, for example, means both drawing and painting, and is used to mean art too. If there is no equivalent for it in art history's lingua franca, how are we to speak of baji without overriding its implications? We might also do well to be more mindful of how we think and reason our observations, for it's the way we think about the world that we see differently too. In line with Aung San's practice, this lecture proposed the lenses of Buddhist thought. In my previous papers, I have consistently argued for the model of Shantiniketan, the fruit of anti-colonial pan-Asian aspirations tempered by Tagore's humanist and universalist vision, not just for Aung San, but also Southeast Asia and even East Asia. What might be other ways? Histories are written and canons are formed when what was once unseen becomes visible, expressible, and desirable. They are unmade and made again. It is the community of curators, collectors, artists, policymakers, dealers, administrators, and academics that shape them according to the evolving needs of their spaces and times. In this process, art history is a means, just one amongst many. Thank you for your time. I apologize for oversights and any hasty interpretation on my part, and hope that you have the opportunity to articulate your own thoughts on the artist in conversation with what I had proposed. Thank you.